You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. And he said to her, your sins are forgiven. Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace.
that almost worked. So my apologies for that. But basically, it's a story for those of you who do not know about chocolat. Sorry, I try to pretend to be French, so that pronunciation helps to fool you guys. It's basically a story of this lady, the main character, who's the good guy or the good girl. In this case, and she comes into this very fundamentalist town, and then the trailer stops. No, it goes on. She comes into this very fundamentalist town, and where there's a Christian fundamentalism in this small French town in the 1950s or 60s, and she's an atheist, and she tries to breathe life into this community, but she's up against a very staunch Christian fundamentalist tradition, and she struggles in the process. Now, we'll interact a little bit with Chocolat in a second, but I remember watching an episode of The Simpsons a while ago. So some of you might know the theological program called The Simpsons, and in this one episode, Bart is expelled from his elementary school. So he's been in elementary school for the last 25 years, and he's expelled from it. And the only school that's willing to take him in is a Christian school, all right? And this Christian school's logo or motto is, we put the fun in fundamentalist dogma. Now, that view of Christians is very much, I want to say, exploited, and it's an experience that a lot of people have towards Christianity. There's a lot of movies that illustrate this. There's a movie called Saved. I'm not sure whom of you have seen that, with Mandy Moore. I think she plays the lead role there. And it just depicts, again, this very dogmatic, very religious, fundamentalist Christians. Then there's a movie called Paradise that I just recently saw the trailer. It doesn't look like a very good movie, but again, it depicts Christianity in this way. And to a certain extent, I think that it's fair. Because Christianity has, to a large extent, and for a lot of people, been a little bit of a suppressing party pooper. And a lot of people view us as judgmental, as unkind, as anti-progressive. And if you've been to any church, I want to say in the wider Reformed tradition, you go to these churches and you view their photos that they have of their church council during the years. It's quite a fun exercise. So if you look at some of these Goeie Ou Kerke and the 1970 church council, there's a rule. First of all, you need to wear black. Secondly, you're not allowed to smile when you go there. So it's a little bit like there was this hidden law or this unwritten law in all church council photos of the 60s and 70s within Afrikaans circles that you have to play like it's Pilgrim's Rest. You're not allowed to smile on the photo. And again, if you see that photo, it just shows you this is the fun police. If anybody is having any sort of fun, then they will get you. So this is a caricature that is not entirely untrue. I know for a fact that my denomination that I grew up in, up until about 20 years ago, you were not allowed to dance in that denomination. So other church groups or other people would mock us by saying, so in your church you're allowed to have illegitimate sex as long as it does not lead to dancing. So that was the joke going around. So to a certain extent, this caricature of Christianity is not entirely unfair, being fundamentalist, being a little bit religious and anti-progressive. But I've got bad news for you. If that is your objection, if that is something that you are struggling with, if you are very much, you found yourself to be a victim of this kind of oppressive Christianity, here's the bad news. That view of yours is very biblical. That is a very biblical view. You are in good company. If you object to church fundamentalism, you are very much in the company of Jesus. And a lot of people don't like it because usually when they make that objection, they think they are bashing the church. But as a matter of fact, I think it is a very good argument for why you should in fact follow Jesus, because it is very biblical. Jesus clashed with religion way more than this lead character in Chocolat clashed with religion. I know that because Jesus dies in the end of his ministry. This girl does not die at the end of Chocolat. So sorry if that's a bit of a spoiler alert. She lives. But if you go to the end of Luke, unfortunately, Jesus dies. And that is a symbol, that is an event, and that event is pretty much the result of Jesus clashing with religion. Now let us just look at this text. So we're going through Luke, we're in Luke 7 now, and Aboke read to us in her very sophisticated Ugandan accent. So sorry that you have to listen to this very flat Afrikaans accent after that. I'm never going to have her speak before me again. From now on, you're only allowed to do prayers in the end, Aboke. Now, what I want to go through this passage, and there's a couple of things that I want to translate for our modern ears. The first one is Pharisee. When we, in the 21st century, hear the word Pharisee, we immediately think, a Pharisee is a bad person. So if you call somebody a Pharisee, you're trying to insult that person. If you called somebody a Pharisee in the first century in Palestine, they would have said, well, thank you very much. That's a wonderful compliment. That's like calling somebody a Western province supporter or something as flattering as that. So Pharisees weren't necessarily the bad guys. We can translate it much better in a modern context as the good conservative theologian, the good conservative theologian, or the pastor. So one of the pastors asked Jesus to eat with him. So let's just break this whole idea of Pharisees being bad people. All right. So it starts off with a Pharisee or a theologian inviting Jesus for supper. And then there's this massive moment that happens. We know this because it says, and behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment. Now, the word and behold was our giveaway. That is like New Testament way of saying, what is going on here? I was about, what the hell is going on here? So it is this big, big moment. And behold, this woman comes in. Now, one thing that we need to realize is that privacy was not that big a deal in the ancient Near East. It's a big thing for us. We built fences around our houses. We even have teenagers putting up signs telling their parents who live in the same house that they're not allowed to cross this barrier. But I'm afraid in the first century Palestine, that privacy wasn't so well developed. As a matter of fact, when you had a dinner like this, members of the public were allowed to come to the dinner. Although they were not allowed to eat, they were allowed to watch. Now, if you're one of those people who don't like it when people look at you eating, then you can be very glad that you're not 2,000 years old. Because at the beginning of your 2,000-year-old life, a lot of people would have stared at you whilst you are eating. So it's open. You can walk into this house whilst these people eat, and you can observe their conversation. I kid you not. This is how things worked. Now, you weren't allowed to say anything, and you weren't allowed to eat anything. So you were only allowed to watch. This is before the days of cinema or rugby or anything meaningful that we can do with our time. You were allowed to do that fun thing, go and watch people eat. So when they eat, they reclined at a table. So they didn't sit in chairs. So you guys must be very grateful for the fact that you sit in chairs. They reclined at a table, which is a fancy English word for lying next to a table, which is the best way to eat, by the way. It's great for indigestion, or not for digestion. It's not good for indigestion, but it's great for digestion. You would lie on the left side of your body, and then you would eat with your right hand. And it's very important, because if you got that wrong, you would have been in trouble. You always eat with your right hand, not your left hand. Because, and I'm sorry for this, left hand was more for toilet purposes. This is a day before toilet paper and pretty much before water. All right? Remember, these people live in the desert. So the left hand, not a good hand. The right hand, that's your clean hand. That's your eating hand. So you would lie on your left hand, you would eat with your right hand. If you get that mixed up, people, you will not be invited back to a dinner party. The other problem is, living in the desert, it's kind of hard to stay clean. Remember that water is a very rare commodity. So if you pitch up at somebody's place, what usually needs to happen is you need to be washed a little bit, especially your feet, because your feet is entirely exposed. They walk around with sandals. Now, if you've ever walked in on a gravel road or something like that, your feet get dirty. And remember, they are lying down next to a table. So their feet is pretty much eye level with everybody else. So the guests, or not the guests, the spectators who are looking at them eating can see these ugly feet. And the other thing is, it's not that fun to have filthy feet kind of eye level just behind you if it's not your own and you're eating. All right, it's a bit of a social no-no. So this is happening, and a woman bursts onto the scene, and behold a woman. And it says, and behold a woman who was a sinner. Again, this is a biblical euphemism for what? A prostitute. All right? And behold, a prostitute. All right, so if we translate this into very modern day English, it would sound a lot more rough than what it's sounding right now. And behold, a prostitute comes in. Now, although the houses are open, although anybody's welcome to come in and observe this meal, if you're a prostitute, you should rather not come in and observe. It's a bit of a social barrier that's outside, and you should not cross it. So she comes in, and she's there. Now, at that stage, you can imagine Simon the Pharisee is a little bit nervous because there's a prostitute watching him and his guests while they eat. And that's even uncomfortable for us today, but it was especially uncomfortable for a Pharisee in the first century. And now she wants to wash Jesus' feet. She wants to anoint his feet, but she is so overwhelmed by emotion that it says, and then she cried all over Jesus' feet. Can you see that this is a bizarre situation that's going on here? They've got this, from our perspective, bizarre dinner going on. In runs a prostitute, and behold, a sinner. And she goes to Jesus' feet and starts to cry all over Jesus' feet. And it says, she wet his feet with her tears. Now, friends, I'm not an expert on this, but to really wet somebody's feet with just fluids coming from your face is quite impressive. So we are not talking about Hollywood tears. We are talking about a woman losing control. Forgive me for this. This is a bit of a gross sermon up to date. But we're talking about spit and mucus and a very, very emotional woman dribbling over Jesus' feet. This is what's happening. And she just came in there to anoint his feet, and everything goes south. And she does that. She wets his feet. And now up to this moment, it's a bit of a social no-no. I think we've established that. But then she does the worst thing a woman could possibly do in this Israeli culture. And you know what's that? She loosens her hair. Now, I'm glad you guys are sitting when I'm telling you this. But she loosened her hair. To loosen your hair in Israeli culture was the equivalent of exposing your breasts, all right? So when you loosen your hair, not when you lose your hair, when you lose your hair, you go bald. When you loosen your hair as a woman, then you're pretty much flashing everybody around you. I know that Jewish men in the first century had an amazing imagination, but they didn't like that. And then she loosens her hair and she uses it as a towel to clean up Jesus' feet because, remember, she's dribbled all over it. And everybody looks at this situation and think, if Jesus was really who he said he is, If this guy is really a prophet, if this guy is really amazing, then he will know that this woman is a prostitute. Then he will know that there's something incredibly wrong with this whole situation. As a matter of fact, a lot of commentators agree that when Simon says, and I can't believe if he knew who this woman was, he would not allow her to touch him. That touch has a sexual undertone. So the Message translation, the Eugene Peterson translation, translates it as, he will not allow her to be all over him. So this thing has a bit of a sexual connotation as well. And it is, like we said, an entirely social no-no, to say the very least. And we end up with a prostitute in somebody's house. She's pretty much party crashed their date, with a red face, crying out of control, and now she has muddy hair. And this is the situation that we are in as of this moment. The Pharisee asks himself, how can Jesus allow this? He's going against every social convention. And Jesus preempts this, and he answers, or he responds by saying, Simon, do you know what? You are in no place to criticize this woman on social convention. You are in no place whatsoever to criticize this woman for how she's acted socially, because you have not really acted socially very, very well. Why do we say that? He then goes on to say what Simon did wrong. The first of it is he did not wash Jesus' feet. Now remember, the washing of the feet was very important in this desert culture, and again, the reclining at the table. But also, it was a very demeaning job. So usually slaves would do it, or they would provide people with water so that they can wash their own feet. Which gives us a little bit of a context what Jesus did when he washes his disciples' feet. It was, again, ridiculous for a teacher, for a rabbi, for the master to wash his servants' feet. You don't want to touch people's feet. Even today, it's not a fun thing to do. So it was something that was subjected to, it was slave labor, so to speak, all right? That's the first thing you need to do. The other thing you do is you give the person who comes to visit you a brotherly kiss. Remember, this is a kissing culture again. So you put your hand on the person's shoulder and you kiss that person, which is kind of the equivalent today of saying, hi, welcome to my house. And we've definitely moved on in some significant and good ways as well. And the third thing is, remember that these people are very dry. Their skin that's exposed are very dry. So they put oil on their face and all the bits that's exposed to the sun so that it's not that dry. The skin is not that dry. And those are the three customary things that you do if somebody comes to you. And for some reason, Simon the Pharisee neglected to do these respective things. Why, we do not know. Why he invited Jesus in the first place, we're not entirely sure. Whether he was trying to mock Jesus in some way, whether they were trying to court Jesus, whether he just had a bad day and forgot to do all those customary things, I'm not entirely sure. But he didn't do the basics very well on this particular day in terms of social convention. And here's the whole thing. You do this, and by focusing on the rules, you're always focusing on religion. Here's my message to you. Your problem is, when you're playing the rules and when you're always trying to obey the rules, you are missing the person. You are missing the person that is behind these rules. And this is the problem with religion. You look at the law and the rules in and of itself, and you forget what it's pointing to. It's pointing to a person. And one of the nice things about Jesus is when he came into this world, this person that it points to, is he just bring colors into the society. There is not a person in this world that's done more for humanitarian work than the person of Jesus Christ. And he comes in this dark world, this black and white photos, and he just brings color in there. He liberates people. That is why this woman can go crazy, because she feels liberated for the first time in her life. That is why when Jesus comes into the picture, there's color, there's life. As he says himself, I came to bring life, and I came to bring life abundantly. Here's another problem. this woman, and a lot of us today, was caught up in this social machine, this social mechanism that we call gossip today. Now, gossip helps us to label people, doesn't it? So when we look at all these glam, magazines, or when we do it in small circles or on a bigger level, we are trying to label people in a certain way. This person doesn't dress well, that person is sexually immoral, this person is lazy, whatever the case may be. That's how we determine who's in and who's out. And this woman is very much caught up in this. And for the Pharisee, for Simon, he can't see through this. And then Jesus does something that I think is striking. I think it's actually the climax of the story, and this is it. And turning towards the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? Do you see this woman?" And there's an emphasis on it. Now remember, a guy like Simon is not supposed to even look at a woman like that, but he's emphasizing it again. Do you see this woman? Try and see her outside of the lenses of your social construct. Try to see her out of your lenses of prejudice and judgmentalism. Just try and see this woman who is liberated, who is so happy to have a fresh start. Just try and see this woman. And guys, for us today, this message is loud and clear. Because we like to label people as well. So we can laugh at these people, we can laugh at the Pharisees, but that would be hypocritical because we do it ourselves. There are certain family members that annoys us and we've already labeled them in that box. And we can't see that person for who she or he might be because we've already put them in that box. You tell me, if somebody walks in here with a red EFF beret on his head, are you going to label that person? Yes. Yes, you are. Are you going to be suspicious of that person? Yes. Are you going to avoid that person? Probably. Jesus says, "Do you see this man?" And you say, "Well, yeah, I can see. Obviously, he's an EFF. No, 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 no. Let's take the beret off. Do you see this person? He always goes deeper. That's the amazing thing about Jesus. He always breaks these labels and he takes you deeper. And probably the most beautiful thing is the fact that Jesus gives us a new start. And if you've messed up in life, you would know how precious this is. If you haven't messed up in life, just give yourself a little bit of time, you'll get there. But there's nothing so precious as the idea of a fresh start. I remember, quite ashamedly, in my first year, I'm trying to make friends, and there's this one guy in our hostel that's annoying everybody. And I get some dirt on him. I heard his badge, his head boy badge, was confiscated from him because they caught him cheating in an exam. Now, everybody don't like that guy. This other guy looks kind of interesting. I want to be his friend. So I bring him this gossip. I know it sounds like I'm a teenage girl, but I went to him and I said, "Yes, you can't believe. You know that guy that annoys everybody? That guy was expelled from his school because he cheated and he was head boy. I mean, what do you make of that?" And this guy responded, and it was such an anticlimax. He said, "Well, the good thing of coming to university is the fact that we can start again. We can start new." Now, that's not a very fun way to get the conversation going, because there I'm standing, "Huh? What do you say of this gossip?" And he just says, "Well, the nice thing is we can start all over again." A fresh start, ladies and gentlemen, is something very, very precious. Especially if you've really messed up. And this woman obviously really messed up. So Jesus tells the story about the two debtors, all right? The two people that owed the banker money. So he says there was one guy who owed 500 pieces of silver. There was another one who owed 50, I think it's denarii actually. And he asked Simon, "Whom of these people are going to be most grateful?" And Simon, given the fact that he had a little bit of mathematics in primary school, says, "I suppose the one who owed more." And Jesus said, "You've answered correctly." Have you noticed, and there's some of you who fits in this category, and there's some of you who are annoyed with people who fit in that category. But have you noticed some of these really radical, charismatic Christians that annoys a lot of you, and either you are one of them? But you know what's beautiful about that? It's the fact that a lot of them really went through a tough time. A lot of them really had a bad incident somewhere in their youth or somewhere in their background. And then when they discover Jesus, There's just so much passion. And they realize that I owe him so much, there's no way that I can be right with him. And when it's written off, that guy can't control himself. And you know what happened? He becomes so passionate for Jesus. You've all seen this person. Sometimes he's running around town giving pamphlets or Bibles away, or he's the kind of guy that you walk past him or her and you say, "Hi, how are you?" And they say, "You need Jesus." And I know that's culturally insensitive, but there's something beautiful about it as well, because that person know where he or she was and they know where they are. When Jesus gives us a new start, when we truly understand this whole Christian thing, he's basically giving us new eyes. He's giving us a new worldview. And you know what's the primary word of this new worldview? What is the primary thing? It's called grace. That is the Christian thing. If you want to understand, if you're interested in Christianity, if you don't really understand Christianity, if you're looking for one word to define Christianity, here it is. It's grace. And it takes it absolutely to the next level. You see, the problem with the Pharisee, who's thinking in these categories of, I owe Jesus little, I owe God little because I'm okay with him, I'm managing my sin, and this other person who realizes that he or she is really in trouble, the problem with that whole analogy is the fact that we're all basically insolvent. It doesn't matter how much you owe, the point is, you're in no position to pay for it. Do you get the distinction? It doesn't really matter how much you owe, whether it's 50 pieces of silver or 500 pieces of silver. Here's the thing, you are in no position to pay for that. That's why grace is equally important for you as the bad person as for you as the moderately good person. And here's another thing about sin, and I've used this illustration quite a few times, but if I and, let's say me and Chad Leclos, so the girls can use 5 seconds to think about that, and let's say we go for a swim from I wanted to say Johannesburg, but that's difficult, from Durban to Australia. Who will win between me and Chad? Did you say Chad? Okay. We're going from Durban to Australia. I don't have a map here. It's very, 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 very far. Who's going to win that swimming competition? Nobody. The sea's going to win. All right? We're going to lose. Now, let's say they've tracked us with some sort of monitoring device, and they go on Google Earth, and they see where did Chad end and where did Johan end. You won't see the difference. And I mean, Chad is not a bad swimmer, but you won't see the difference. Even if I still use inflatable things on my arms, on Google Earth, in this massive, massive stretch of sea, you will not see the difference. And that's the point that God is trying to make. He's saying that in the sea of sin, in the oceans of sin, it's much bigger than what you think. Your best effort is going to be minute on Google Earth. That's a bit of a loose translation. But it's what it comes down to. It's going to be minute in this massive thing. So you, my friend, is in equal need of forgiveness. The only way that you cannot get this forgiveness is if you exclude yourself from the need to have forgiveness. Does that make sense? The only way that you can refuse this forgiveness is if you think you do not need it. And that is a problem with both sides of the spectrum, because if you're this religious zealot kind of guy who manages your sin and manages God, you're trying to tell God, I'm kind of okay. You need to give me at least a penthouse suite with a balcony when I get to heaven. I'm doing my best. I'm really managing my sin. That's a problem, because he thinks he's not really in need of forgiveness. But the same is true of the guy on the left-hand side. So let's just call it on the right-hand side, the zealot, conservative fundamentalist, and on the left-hand side, let's say the liberal hippie, or the modern person today, or the Hollywood individual, if I can call it that. They would just get rid of the category of sin. So the one says, I've got little sin. The other one says, there's no such thing as sin. So you define relationships in this way? I don't think so. I don't call it sin. You talk about monogamy? I just think that's Western capitalism. I don't really call it sin. You say abortion is wrong. Well, I'm saying that the individual is important. I'm free to make my own decisions. Can you see how both of them are trying to get away from sin? The one is trying to manage his or her sin, keeping it to the limit. The other one has just got rid of the category of sin. There's no such thing. Both of them are in serious trouble because you just have to acknowledge that you have a problem. And that's when grace can flow. Grace can only flow in the absence of self-righteousness. That's the only place where grace can fully work its magic. And you know, it's a beautiful thing. When I think of some of the great Christian thinkers that I like to read and reflect on, guys like the Apostle Paul, you know what he said of himself? He's the greatest sinner of them all. I think it's in 1 Timothy 1:15. He says, Christ came to die for all our sins, of whom I'm the biggest sinner. Now, surely the Apostle Paul should be okay. I mean, that guy has done well. Sure, he had a bad stint in the beginning, but he really made up for it after that. He calls himself the biggest sinner. If you read the books of St. Augustine, if you read books of Malcolm Muggeridge or C.S. Lewis, even these pious guys that we at least would view as pious, like Francis of Assisi, when those guys write about themselves, it's messy. They don't regard themselves as holy. And maybe that is why we are reading about them in the first place. Because by knowing the extent of their own heart, they can really flourish within grace. Maybe that's why they are these great Christian leaders, because they acknowledged that there's something fundamentally wrong with them. We spoke about Christianity that's best defined as this term, as this word grace. But I would like to add that it's sometimes so difficult to really get to that point. Because a lot of us, especially if you're in the church, have been hurt by people that call themselves Christians, that has done rude or hard things. So you've maybe been touched in a very horrible way by this religious fundamentalism. And if that's the case for you, and I've got another good news for you. You're in good company because Jesus was also hurt by religious fundamentalism. But I need to say something else as well. If you really felt that you've been the victim of that, I need to tell you, and I want to do this with all sensitivity, get over it. The reason I say get over it is the fact that we're humans. And somebody once said that the heart of the human problem is the human heart. And that's true. We are human and we suck. And whether you're going to be in this church or whether you're going to be in a Rotary club or whether you're going to be part of a book reading club or a post-collection thingy, the fact of the matter is where people and where there's brokenness, you are going to get hurt. So a lot of people would come to Dialoog and they would say, this is finally a place. I'm so tired of the church. I want to come here. You guys don't look very churchy. And I got hurt in that institution or whatever. And I usually stop that person immediately and say, well, you know what? If you're going to hang around here for another 5 minutes, you're probably going to be offended by someone. All right. And it's going to be a little bit less if I stay around. We are broken people. But here's the problem. If you are putting your faith in an institution, if you are putting your faith in an organization, then you're always going to be disappointed. But here's what Jesus tells us. Don't put your faith in an organization. Put your faith in me. Yes, there's a lot of Christians that's done horrible things in the name of Christ. It happened to Jesus himself. But don't look at that. Look at me. And that's what that woman did. She broke all social convention. She just ran into that door and she was focused on Jesus. She wasn't focused on this set of rules. When Jesus comes into the picture and we really look at Jesus, there's a beautiful thing, and that is, he gives us eyes of grace. He gives us those eyes. And I've noticed it in myself. When I get angry about something, I just know I have to pray. And I'm a little bit annoyed at praying because I realize that after I've prayed, I'm not going to be angry anymore, and I want to be angry for a little while longer. So I want to delay this grace. But I know that it's going to come as soon as I talk to God, because he gives me his eyes of grace. And in this country, where the church has a bit of a bad reputation, especially the Afrikaans church, in what happened in apartheid, and there's loads of other instances through history, we need to remind ourselves and we need to remind people that we need to look at Jesus, because you can't look at Jesus for an extended time and walk away without eyes of grace. And that is the way you see the world around you. Let's just quickly pray for a second as we reflect on this notion of grace. Lord, there's as many stories in this room as there are people. And there's people who's hurt, there's people carrying a grudge, there's people maybe caught up in the systems themselves without realizing it. And Lord, what we need more of in this world is you. And Lord, what defines you best is probably this whole notion of grace. And it is truly my prayer that when we look at you, that you will give us a new heart, not one of stone, but one of flesh, that you will give us new eyes, and that we'll be able to see the world in that way, that we will be able not only to look at things that annoys us easily, like politicians or, let's say, a family member or a colleague at work or whatever, that we can look at all of this world with eyes of grace, and that we will realize that when we live a good life, that it's not to earn anything. It is not to earn your love. It is because of your love. It's in a reaction. When we live with this kind of freedom, it is not to earn it, but it's because we have it. We thank you for that, Lord. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I want us to have a second go at our technology by listening and reading a song called Grace. Kind of fits into the theme of tonight. It's by a small band, maybe you've heard of them, called U2. And if Pika, if you can get that song up and running for us, we can just get the words on there as well. Thanks. Thank you. Because grace makes beauty out of ugly things. I think it is very well put by our friends, our Irish friends, you too. So guys, there's an opportunity now to ask some questions. Niku, if you can just grab the microphone there. So there's a roaming mic, if you would be so gracious to maybe make a comment or a question, that would be nice. There's some coffee, there's some water. Before we do that, you'll notice there's a small baby running around, and I would like to make it clear that I am an uncle to that baby. Thank you very much. And a lot of people think that it's not true, given the fact that the baby has hair and is moderately attractive, but my sister is responsible for Amelie, and they are visiting from England over here, and Charlie is here somewhere as well, and so you don't have to give them a round of applause, but maybe you want it. All right. And then you'll also see Tabang. Tabang is our friend from Timbisa, and he also came and visit. So Tabang, thank you for coming so far. I mean, apart from Olmi and them that just lives around the corner in England, you came from far, so thanks for that. All right, any questions? Yaku?
Okay, well then, just... Mm. What's always interesting for me is once again we here have the fine line between reserving judgment or making judgment calls versus judging people. Mm. That we seem so easily, you know, it's so easy for us to get that wrong. And I mean, obviously we have moral standards and we do see something like prostitution as being wrong and so forth, but that does not mean that we should not treat the prostitute well. Mm. So that's the, once again, Jesus gets it right, but the other people struggle with it.
Yeah, so I think we did talk about it a couple of weeks ago when it's about the sermon on the plain, which says, judge not and you will not be judged. And a lot of people think, I like this verse. So they do whatever they want, and whenever somebody approaches them, they just throw, sorry, judge not and you will not be judged. But if you look at the wider context there, it's referring to judgmentalism, and there's a massive difference. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, love does not find fault. And that's what we're seeing over here, people who's really out to get you, who's really looking for those bad things. And probably the best modern day depiction of that is, again, our glossy magazines. Where is she? What did she do there? What did that celebrity do? And we like to pinpoint those things. That's That's judgmentalism. And as Christians, we should be against that. But to judge certain actions, we are entirely within our rights to do that. As a matter of fact, what Jesus does, and this is the difference, this is what makes Christian judgmental judgment different, is if you realize or if you identify a practice that was wrong, you have to realize that if that person responds to that, she or he moves in grace. So it's a clean slate. They start from the beginning, and that's wonderful. But that does not necessarily condone what happened before that. This is the reaction, and we will react in grace, but that does not necessarily condone what you said or what you did on this side. Is there a... Sorry, we don't have a microphone, so you just have to speak up, Louise.
Okay. Something that's seldomly mentioned is what happens to the Pharisees. And there are quite a number of them in the New Testament. I think what's often overlooked is that Jesus doesn't reject the Pharisee.
Yeah.
That's something, because there's a certain kind of self-righteousness that very easily slips in.
Absolutely. That's the problem. So if we look and we laugh at these Pharisees and we laugh at these judgmentalism, that's what happens. I mean, Louise, it's so ironic. But let's think of the in the United States. There's this big conversation, as you know, about the gay marriages that's recently been legalized, and the church has been horrible in its approach to homosexuality. There's been horrible things over there, and they've been accused of being judgmental. But now you see them reacting in very much the same way. When people say, "You know what? I think I reserve a relationship, a marriage." For this, and this is my view of marriage, then you are called a bigot or an idiot or whatever. So you can see how it's gone full circle. So you had judgmentalism over here, and now you just have the other circle again being very judgmental. And that just shows you how easy it is for these things to go around like that. So you're entirely right. We are in no position. And that's why I try to translate the word Pharisee into pastor, because hopefully you guys do not all hate pastors. Maybe it's a bit of a neutral term to you at least, or theologian or whatever. And I think I've mentioned this a couple of times, but when you read the Bible, maybe try this for a second. When we read the story of David and Goliath, then I'm always David, obviously. I'm the good guy. But what if I'm Goliath? What if I'm the bad guy? I know it's not very fun if you play David and Goliath in the backyard and, no, I'm David, no, I'm, because you know how the story ends. It's never fun. But maybe we're not the good guys all the time. Maybe we are the Pharisees. Maybe we are the Goliaths. And that's what Jesus tries to tell you. If you look and you mock these historical characters, these historical opponents of Jesus. I wonder if he comes today and the new Testament is written in this context, then a lot of us who regard ourselves as okay may be the villains. That's something to think about. Thanks, Louise. Yeah, yes, speak up.
It's very safe to say no, you shouldn't judge anybody or something, but then there's also some things that Paul writes about in his letters about times when we need to take things on. The church, for example, somebody in the church is clearly greedy or practicing drunkenness or immorality or whatever, where those kind of things need to be addressed. So where's the difference between, in your view, you know, dealing with something like that and another Christian? Of course, it's not a Christian, you have no business talking to a person about it. But let's say, people in the church know that someone's having an affair in the church. How do you handle that?
Well, remember it also depends where that place of judgment is coming from. So the guy, Paul, who judges these various bad things in the church, says of himself, I am the worst bad person. So that first levels the playing field to a certain extent, if that is the place where it's coming from. So that's one of the first things I would say. The other thing is that we tend to read the Bible very selectively. So let's think of that list that Paul names, you know, greed and gluttony and homosexuality. He calls a couple of names. The church picks their favorite and focus on that one. So they'll focus on, oh, homosexuality, bad. But it's a massively overweight pastor that is sweating profusely and screaming at these bad homosexuals. Well, it's in the same passage. Just go back 3 words. You're in trouble as well. So when you realize that there's it's hard to be excluded from this, then I think there's a bit of a different approach in how we do this thing as well. But there's no doubt that the Bible makes certain very objective statements and it judges it. There's no doubt that we are excited for when Jesus comes to judge the world. The Bible don't think that judgment is a negative thing. We're excited. We're looking forward to the day that Jesus comes and judges the world because he's going to set it to right. So when a guy like William Wilberforce looked at the thing of slavery and said, I am judging this thing to be wrong, that is a good thing. We can look at the judgment that Wilberforce made and we can say, thank God for that. We can look at some of the judgment that came from the Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and we can celebrate some of the judgment that comes from that. So this is not a freebie, this is not anarchy, but it tells us that it always comes from a place of grace, and it comes from a place of grace because we are all sinners. We are all in need of grace, but that doesn't exclude judgment. And I mean, Paul is quite clear on that. Maybe one last comment or question. Yes, Tabang.
Tell an open rebuke.
Yeah, so what's the difference between rebuking and being judgmental? Yes. Well, it's easier, I think. Rebuke happens in love. Judgmental happens from self-righteousness. So that's the difference. There's this wonderful passage where they ask Jesus, because obviously he seems very tolerant. So they want to put him down. Okay, how tolerant must I be? So just give us something. We get this whole thing about tolerance. You're doing amazing miracles, so we want to follow you, but there's really annoying people out there doing bad things, so how tolerant should we be? And so he says, well, we need to forgive. And what you need to do, if somebody did something against you, you go and speak to that person. If that person doesn't listen to you, you go away, you go get another person who comes with you, a friend, which we call an interfriendship, and you tell this person what you disagree with. And what happens then? Jesus says, ultimately, you can walk away, and then you can treat that person as a sinner and a tax collector. Here's the problem. How did Jesus treat sinners and tax collectors? So it's always in love. Sorry, it's always from within that. But as soon as that becomes a power play that you want to affect over the person, back off. Don't go there. Don't go close. Really, really pray. Get that inner peace so that when you talk to that person, you are very much aware of all your faults, and there's a lot of them. You're very much aware of them, and then you can approach that person. And if that person is really, really, really staunch, don't worry, you can treat them like a sinner and a tax collector, which is love them. Nico.
Yuan. So I've got 2 questions. I'm going to hopefully sneak in the second one, but it doesn't seem as if Jesus really had that much love for the Pharisees. He seems a little bit sarcastic and quite harsh. So how do you respond to that?
I would say that love is not sentimental. You can be harsh. You can be straight. But that doesn't mean that it's not love. That's the one thing. The other thing, and a little bit scared to say this, but They were supposed to get it. The Pharisees, the theologians, the pastors were supposed to tell about Jesus coming. They were supposed to be talking about and getting the people ready for Emmanuel, God with us. And they don't get it. And here's a very scary thing. In the book of James, he says that people who preach, people who lead, will be judged more seriously. Which is not a great endorsement for any theological faculty. But I think Jesus acts in that way because they had no excuse to not get it. They had all the tools. They had the scriptures. They had the time to go through it. They are seeing these things, and yet they are not responding to it. So I think maybe that is where that is coming from. And there's something about, to quote another very famous philosophical work called Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And they had the power, they had the tools, they could see these things, and yet they didn't do it. That's why I try my best, and listen, this is a mistake, and it's something that you can hold me accountable to as a community. But I try to look over a lot of sins because I know God does it to me. There's two things that I really struggle with. One is people littering. I've got a bit of a problem with that. And I've been in numerous road rage accidents where I get onto the N1, get the package, drive to the person, give it back to him, and it's not very safe, and it's a little bit stupid. But the other thing that I validate my judgmentalism is when I meet Christian racists. Because I've seen a lot of people who would build a school, and they'll call it a Christian Afrikaans school, for example, but it's just a smokescreen to justify their racism, to keep people out. Now, I'm in no position to do this, but I think that they should know better. If you use Christianity as an active means to exclude certain people, I think you're in trouble. I think you're open to judgment, because that is the only place where I see Jesus really pronouncing judgment over other people, is when they use this Christian thing, to exclude certain people. He doesn't pronounce judgment over the tax collectors, or the sinners, or the prostitutes, or whatever. He does it towards these people who excludes them by having this, what do you call it, this silver bullet in their hands. Now, I don't think it's right from my side, but I think that's where it's coming from. We have no excuse to keep people out with this beautiful, beautiful thing that is the gospel. I think we're going to stop on that note. Friends, next week we're going to camp. And if you are not planning to camp, please come on this Saturday. It is in Cullinan. You have absolutely no excuse. It's going to be wonderful. I'm willing to excuse my family who will be in England, but only just. So please try and come to the camp this weekend. And then I'm very glad to say next week Sunday, Dirk, who seemed to have disappeared for a second, he's gonna preach here at Dialoog. So I heard there was a woohoo over there. I wish I could get the same enthusiasm. The week after that, it's me again. You see, nothing. So it just works like that. All right, friends, there's water, there's coffee, there's strangers. Please talk to somebody you do not know. Have grace.